This podcast features three supposed adults who definitely use adult language. They're also supposedly writers who are definitely not procrastinating by making this podcast. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to No Bad Ideas, the storytelling game show where we take the worst ideas from the internet and try to turn them into stories that are actually good.
That's correct. The key word there being try.
Do or do not, Gabriel.
No. Oh, there absolutely is such a thing as try. Sometimes we defeat the badness and sometimes...
Well, do we?
I'm Zach Valenti.
I'm Gabriel Urbina.
I'm Sarah Shackett.
I'm Amanda McLaughlin.
Yes, we are joined today by the wonderful podcaster, the creator of Multitude and co-host of Spirits Podcast. Amanda, thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
We are so excited to have you here to help us turn a bad idea that Zach is inordinately excited about.
It's really bad.
Into a
it's
good
the worst bragging one about this for yet. A little bit.
In case you've never listened to this show before, welcome. We're so glad that you're here. We are going to now listen to something that Mr. Zach found online of somebody having what can only be described as a terrible, no good, very, very bad idea.
Oh, yeah.
And that then, the three of us have, the three others of us have not heard before.
And then we're going to have a certain amount of time to try to turn it into a good story. And it's like, what did we say? We said 4 weeks. We said like 6 months.
Oh, we're going to be here for the month, right?
It's a residency.
Yeah.
Yes, correct.
We have 30 minutes.
Oh. Okay, well, without any further ado, shall we?
Oh, boy.
So this lovely gem comes from the darkest corner of Reddit that I've found yet.
Okay.
I believe...
What is the subreddit?
The subreddit was either WTF or something else awful.
Could be a charming one.
I actually forget because I went deep.
Right, like WTF can cut either way.
Yeah.
That's
what makes it so dangerous.
It's on r/todayilearned.
Ah,
okay.
All right.
That's actually pretty wholesome.
Yeah, no, there can be
shadows, but overall that one is pretty wholesome.
Yeah.
Well,
I am taking a sip of tea because I'm sure that nothing that's about to be said in the next 10 seconds is going to shock me.
I don't spend much time on Reddit, by the way. It's a new thing. I spent a whole 30 minutes this time. I had to take a shower. Okay, so this is an actual source... Kotaku.com.
Oh, yeah.
Kotaku.
Thank you for the pronunciation.
And if you are listening to this, you will be able to find a link to the article in the description for this podcast episode.
And the title of the article is "The Maker of the Troll Face Meme."
Okay.
Is Counting His Money.
Uh huh.
An article by Patrick Klepek.
Someone on the internet was able to monetize something? What?
Right. So here we go.
I didn't know that was allowed.
Yeah. And not just that, but like this iconic meme. You're probably familiar with this image, the infamous, quote, troll face that circulated the internet for years. Someone drew the original troll face, and it's 24-year-old Carlos Ramirez. Back in 2008, Ramirez should have been working on a college paper, but... as was the case on most nights, he found himself scrolling through the anonymous image board 4chan instead. He decided to post a comic drawn up in MS Paint, something he'd done a dozen times before. I didn't really have an intention to share it, he told me. I just posted it on their video game board and I went to sleep. I woke up the next morning and saw it reposted a number of other threads.
Uh-huh.
What he posted would, in short order, become internet myth and legend. And there's a terrible drawing here. The next day, though, Ramirez was merely pleased to see others sharing his one-off doodle. In this anonymous world of 4chan, having other people recognize your contribution felt good. Coincidentally, he
Wait. Something on 4chan felt good?
Oh, no.
This was a bygone era, guys.
Other people recognize your contribution. It feels nice to have your contribution recognized. I don't know. Coincidentally, he'd planned a lengthy trip away from the internet after posting the troll face.
Someone had good boundaries after internet fame?
Yeah, one moment.
It wasn't famous yet. It was just like, around.
Posting something and then taking a lengthy internet.
Yeah.
I can sympathize with that.
I feel like I can summarize this.
I feel like it's subtweeting me specifically, who just sits on Twitter on days when my episodes come out. Not doing anything. I'm just watching, hoping people say things.
Refresh.
Yeah.
So like basically he like posted it, walked away, came back like, oh, like a couple people like it. And then he posted it and he comes back and people really love this.
And then, what happens?
He came back and like 7 years later, he's not sure why this particular image really took off as like.
Same, dude.
Part of the public's. Internet's public face for years, one of the few jokes that transcended its origins and became part of the mainstream consciousness. I have no idea, he laughed. It's simple. It's really recognizable at various sizes. I don't know. It's got the striking design. It wasn't intentional. I'm not a graphic designer. I do some art, but that was not a good drawing. Definitely not my best work. Though Trollface has become its own thing, a way of winking at the internet's mischief, the comic itself was meant to criticize poor forms of trolling. On 4chan and elsewhere, Ramirez would notice users being called out for making a poor argument or using incorrect information, but claim they were, quote, trolling the whole time merely to save face. That's what that whole little Trollface comic was about. Trolling is an excuse for being an idiot, he said.
I have no idea.
When Trollface took off, Ramirez was 18 years old, living with his parents and unsure how to tell people in his life he'd managed to create a bona fide internet sensation. How do you explain why a joke you made is influencing Deadpool comics? It took a while, he said, to get out of that phase of, oh, it's so uncool telling your parents about internet stuff, just sharing your life in general. For a while, the only family member who knew about the Trollface was his younger sister. She kept a lid on it, he said. Then she slipped up. His parents found out about Trollface. To his surprise, his mother was incredibly proud of her son's creation and immediately wanted to celebrate it. I regret telling them because my mom has actually spray painted a Trollface on the side of the house somewhere, he said. She's very much a mom. I'm so proud of my kid. He made a little internet thing. So every morning I'd wake up and you could see it perfectly visible.
Oh my God.
His father had no problem with the internet meme, but he didn't approve of the spray painting. He was kind of upset, he said. It's still there. I'm sure it will be for years.
I have to know every detail. Did the mom do it herself? Did she contract somebody to do it? Go to Home Depot and was like, I need something that'll really stand out against the vinyl. Like,
right.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing? It was, it was all the best for the best, however, since his mother's encouragement is what led him to staking his personal claim over Trollface and registering with the U.S. Copyright Office in 2010.
All right.
Don't believe me? A quick search of the government's database pulls up the following entry. Registering Trollface has been reliably profitable for Ramirez since registering the copyright. I'm sorry, this is kind of a long one, but I feel like
you can get so reliable profit details. On the internet. Tell me more.
Right? Since registering the copyright in 2010,
I thought these were bad ideas we were supposed to be talking
about. Yeah.
I'm just taking notes, frankly.
He estimates he's made a little over $100,000 in licensing fees, settlements, and other payouts associated with Trollface.
Surprised it's that low.
At the meme's height,
we need to get into the 4chan business.
I mean, maybe not there anymore. I don't know.
Timing is everything. But yeah, the right place.
I think the meme business.
What if we did a social platform for viral audio? I'm going to call it Anchor. It's 2011.
Oh, man.
Surely we'll never pivot.
No.
Surely this will end well.
You know, every subsequent sentence made that sound like a better and better idea.
Have you guys heard of Ents, though?
No.
Okay, it's like, sort of like that, but it's different, and it's by the Venmo guys, and I don't understand it, but it's like audio.
The number of things I don't understand on the internet, but anyway.
I think there's only a little bit left here.
Yeah, let's wrap up.
But basically, At the meme's height, when it was plastered on t-shirts at Hot Topic, Ramirez would pull in between 10,000 to 15,000 every few months. Jesus. One document showed him totaled out at 10,000, whatever. These days, the checks aren't as large. He collects a few thousand here and then. He's managed to keep all the troll face financially viable because he continues to enforce ownership of the copyright. Most recently, he had the game Meme Run, an endless runner filled with various internet jokes.
Oh my God.
Pulled down from the eShop on Wii U. Meme Run was free to download on PC and Mac before it showed up on Nintendo's console. On the eShop, it was like $4.99 from Ninja Pig Studios. He became aware of Meme Run through a fan who gave him a friendly heads up. People messaged me being like, hey, look, your troll face was used here. You ought to sue these guys.
Wow.
I just say, okay, I'll look at it. And I look at it. If it's a really minor thing, I can't be too bothered with it. I'm giving him more of a character now. It'll take too much time and let people have their fun. But if they're like, eh, not a big deal. But if you're publishing a game on a major platform and it's using my image, it's kind of hard to ignore. So in the case of Meme Run, it's meme-laden aesthetic is critical to the appeal. It's really troubling when you're making a game comprised of entirely memes, he said. It's a big problem of copyright infringement all across the board, and I guess I was the only one with enough time to go out of my way to shake it down. As a result of Ramirez's inquiries, Meme Run was pulled from the eShop, and the founder of Ninja Pig, Jordan Schutz, was quick to respond to the emails, but said he didn't have any answers. When developing Meme Run, some art assets were taken from content hosted on royalty-free image sites like Open Art Games. The others I created myself in Photoshop. It is uncertain if the game will ever return, despite petitions that fans are currently circulating requesting the game be reinstated.
You just put hashtag fair use in the description and then you can do whatever you want, right?
There you go.
I mean,
no.
All four of us are lawyers, as we know. So that checks out to me.
And so, yeah, the rest of this article is just the minutiae of fighting over meme copyrights.
Oh, Jesus. That sounds so refreshing and rejuvenating.
I'll end it with Trollface may or may not remain a permanent fixture on the internet. It's hard to tell. Memes have a life on their own, and despite owning a copyright, Ramirez doesn't control that part. People will completely forget that I made it, and I think that's cool, he said. That doesn't bother me at all.
All right.
Chill. Right.
Well,
better set a timer.
Start the timer.
I mean, do memes really belong to any of us? Aren't they part of our collective consciousness?
Or are we just an ecosystem of ideas? Like, gene is the lowest, like, smallest unit of genetics and biology. Memes are the smallest unit of idea. There's a Terrence McKenna rant that I listened to recently that I just love. It's just like, oh. Like,
who is Terrence McKenna?
Was a psychedelia sort of like philosopher character, and he had a lot to say about memes as this sort of, like, you know, if there is an environment of ideas, as artists we're promoting those ideas, copying them, sometimes there can be a bad mutation, like the way that sort of Nazism arose out of Friedrich Nietzsche, you know, sort of a mutation of Nietzsche's ideas. But, you know, as artists, we can actually promote healthy memes, which I think is a good meme. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I want to, before we get started, just kind of like zero in on
what the
is the bad idea,
idea
at play here is.
I don't think it's enforcing copyright. I'll go ahead and say that.
No, I...
Like, is it like kind of like the monkey's paw-esque, like wanting to be famous, but posting it in the wrong place sort of a thing?
Or like... What caught my ear about this most was the I didn't want to tell my parents that I was
cute.
Internet famous.
I think the explicitly the bad idea here is trolling as an like using trolling as an excuse for being an idiot. I think you can extend that to being a bad person. And being cruel to others. I think that's the like. Bad idea nugget that let me tell this story to you guys because it was fun to share the article.
But
free to take any of the details and run with it.
Taxi Driver and Fight Club are movies that on the surface examine toxic masculinity, but end up promoting those things.
Oof,
yeah, that kind of a feel.
That's a conversation.
Well, we'll start a different podcast. Yeah,
great.
But people do that. They say, "Oh, it's a pastiche. Oh, it's satire. Oh, I'm just trying
to point
it out."
It's just a joke. Yeah,
but I'm deconstructing it.
Right.
Yeah. Right, but then.
And that's what this comic did. It was about a thing, but ended up being the thing.
A tool of the thing.
Yeah. Mm.
And I think I think there's a lot of bad ideas that you can take from this, even though on the whole, it sounds like a good idea of copyright enforcement for artists' rights and things.
I mean, that's a whole story right there, right? It's like you make a tool to defeat the machine, but it ends up becoming a tool of the machine.
Right. Cool.
So, a story.
Well, there you go.
Are we timered?
Oh, we're timered.
Okay, cool.
27 minutes and counting.
Cool, cool, cool.
Where do we want to start? Stop it.
You woke the cat up.
Where do we want to start in terms of that? Like, that is kind of like a general framework. Do we want to hold on to it being specifically about like internet art and internet memes, or do we want to set it somewhere else?
I'm indifferent. To where we said it. I think that framework, you know, exists with other media forms like television and, you know, network and stuff like that. So I'm down putting it in 4chan if that's what we want to do. Or, you know, the early internet more generally.
We could also go like early newspaper era.
Oh, sure. Like yellow journalism kind of thing.
Are there any details, like characters, that sort of caught your imagination? Or I guess I'm curious what your mind's latched on to, Amanda.
So we're using this this story, we're using that as a framework to tell a different story somewhere else, or we're like revising the conduct so that it's a good idea now?
I think it's fair game. Basically, it's about telling a story that would want to see.
Yeah, okay. Interesting. Yeah, I think something like Rage Against the Machine-y, but it ends up, you know, becoming a tool of the machine. And like, what do you do then with like what you've wrought, you know?
Right.
Right. And the question is whether like it's a Rage Against the Machine sellout kind of a thing. Like our protagonist is sort of pushed closer and closer to the bad behavior that they loathed at the start and becoming what they beheld.
Yeah.
Or whether like just people misinterpret the thing and run with it in another direction, and the protagonist is trying futilely to stop that.
Right.
And I think we could go either way. I don't know.
I think the personal narrative of becoming, of like understanding the thing that you were mocking from the outside before is really like, I'm thinking like Gaga's narrative in A Star Is Born.
Sure.
You know, type of thing.
I need to see that still.
You do. You're going to cry a lot.
I'm ready. I need it.
I like that. Yeah, I can see like a performance artist or you know, a writer, internet, you know, like a
internet
columnist
person,
who is like anonymous, but then starts making money and is like, oh wait, I get it.
I think that no matter what their profession is, I would like them to, I think, be a little bit more aggressively going against whatever the system is, whether it is trolling or this kind of journalism that they don't like. Kind of in this story, it seems to me that this is someone that was kind of vaguely annoyed by something and just kind of dropped a stone into the stream, but didn't think a lot about it. I think that
it's like make some moves.
Yeah, we probably want to animate it a little bit more by having it be sort of something that they are more explicitly going, like, I want to
make a difference here.
Yeah, and I want to take down the trolling system, or I want to take down the whatever infrastructure.
Which is actually an interesting contrast to the way that like most of us behave online. That, you know, moment where he was like, oh, I didn't really think about it or want it to be shared. I just posted it. Like that's, you know, on that sort of unconscious default setting is how most of us act when we are on the Twitter machines, which is why it's such a wonderful place.
Or I often see stuff that I dislike and just mute it or move on.
Right.
Yeah. Like I don't think to take a stand against it.
Because the conventional wisdom is don't feed the trolls.
Exactly.
Like it is only going to amplify it and give it more of a platform to try to engage with it, because you're going to be arguing with the brick wall sooner or later.
Right. Yeah. I like how high up on the ceiling your eyebrows were when you said what a nice place the internet can be, Sarah.
Oh man, I've been in the wars.
That's a good title for the movie. What a nice place the internet can be.
Well, yeah, I guess, and that would be, you know, maybe what this person is fighting for, like a dream, like that sort of utopic vision of the web. You know, if this is someone maybe who was on the early web in the 90s before a lot of people were there and comes back to it after a long break now and like sees what's happened and wants to try and fix it, that would give someone both the motivation to be like more actively trying to clean up Dodge City or whatever, and, you know, a sort of different mode of behavior that's explainable, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It does.
They could also make fun of something they didn't understand, and then that group ended up teaching them something.
That's true, too. Yeah. I like that a lot.
Like, probably the people who were covering up a bad argument by just saying it was trolling are 12 and learning, you know?
Yeah.
Or, you know, like, they're, it's like a reflexive defense against, you know, learning in public, which is hard.
Yes. There was, I think I talked about this on an episode of the show before, but like Patton Oswalt had an interaction with someone that was very negative, and then he went and looked at the gentleman and sort of realized there was a lot going on in that person's life. And
yeah, super bad health problems. Right?
Yeah, and retweeted like the Indiegogo for that. And like, if this was going on, I'd be angry too.
Yeah, changed that guy's life, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so something either like that or, yeah, because so much of 4chan and sort of that stew of the web is 12-year-olds. I think that's a good point. This is maybe someone older who's interacting with them and trying to set a good example and that sort of thing.
Let's see if we can maybe begin to concretize this a little bit.
Sure.
And if we change our minds later, we can always go back. So it sounds like we are kind of falling into, it is sort of a web-based interaction and not, say, you know, like a turn-of-the-century journalism sort of situation, right?
That's what we've been talking about, but I'd be curious to, like, spend one of our precious minutes chasing the journalism
you got
angle.
A little over 20, so yeah, that's you got some time.
Okay, cool.
That's a trap. But no, but sure, let's talk about it.
All right, so what if someone reading the London broadsheets thinks it's all pretentious bullshit, and it's, you know, it's
party
it's all
specific
about shipping,
anyway.
Right? Yeah. It's all about, like, commerce and, like, fuck that noise. And so they start like an anarchist, like one pamphlet.
Sure.
What are the London broadsheets?
So that's like, think of like old timey newspapers where it's like comically large.
Mm-hmm.
That was just a name for like,
it was
just,
a very like, broad
paper
sheet.
Of note, like a main newspaper. Think like New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. It's like a catch-all phrase for that.
Got it.
Because it would just be like a giant page.
Yes.
And then you like fold them over those like wooden racks in a hotel. Mm-hmm. You ever seen those?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool, cool, cool.
So that was like establishment publish, journalism.
Right,
like,
or the, like, oh, sorry. The,
oh, no, go ahead.
Just the fancier, like, rent-a-spaces, like, breather that have, like, those ladders that are just
that's
for
where it comes
magazines
from, right.
now.
Yeah, because oh, you used man, to have, like fancy wooden holders so you wouldn't get ink on your fingers, and then it would be, like, you know, hold it up for you in any case. But, yeah, they were often, I had a project once where I had to, like, look up the day you were born 100, like, minus 100 years.
Oh, cool.
And, like, read the like, Times of London or whatever from that day. And it was all just, like, shipping forecasts and, like, this one was lost at sea and, like, gold, the price of gold was different.
That's the thing about them is that it's not news as we sort of think of it today, because you
it's
know,
like it's like a
it's
just, bulletin board,
yeah, tangible information.
It sounds
yes,
like.
Very much so.
Yeah.
It's like a spreadsheet.
Yeah. So anyway, I can see somebody making a like either like a really irreverent, you know, like this medium can be used for fun and art as well, and then it spirals out of control and like feeds a bad populace, or maybe they you know start it and say like, oh yeah, anyone can do this, and then it like spawns like a zine,
right?
Wave,
sure,
you know, something along those lines, or they start it for like political satire, and then it becomes like personally mean, where people just like go to like subtweet their like husband who cheated.
Oh
you know?
Man, turn of the century subtweeting. I love that.
Oh,
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
like an, maybe it's an anonymous, like a weekly anonymous, you know, like personals. And it started right. as being like, this member of parliament, you know, is taking money from the coal company. And that's why there's new things in his district to like, hey, you know.
That was like kind of an 18th century thing, was just like anonymous character attacks in papers of public figures.
And like written under pen names and stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think that whole period is really interesting. Like, yeah, late 18th, early 19th century.
And it might even be sort of this like power back to the people sort of thing that is like, if you get us something written, we will publish it. No questions
Right.
asked.
It's like a right to be heard.
Yeah.
Right.
What's his face in the French Revolution? Marat? Who did that?
Oh, yes. I believe that is the person that did that. I know who you're thinking.
Yeah, I barely know that the French Revolution happened. That really is where my knowledge stops.
That's fair. No, but there's this dude. He's actually pretty fascinating.
He's like, kind of a badass, but a problematic
badass
one.
And just like sad boy. just sad emo writer kid.
Yeah.
Problematic, badass, sad boy is kind of my brand.
But. Or the peer posting version of that is like Walt Whitman wrote a review of him, of his first book of poetry in the newspaper at which he worked anonymously, calling himself the great American poet because he was like, this is what I want to be, y'all. And I'm just going to call myself it until you agree with
me. Make it till you make it.
Yeah. So and I think it's so pure and beautiful. And anyway, Whitman's a fascinating example of like building the self that you want.
I had no idea he did that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I talked about him on Tess's podcast, Honey Roast.
Wow.
Nice. So that'll be out at some point, yeah.
There's a reason why this is the man that wrote Song of Myself.
And he wasn't, but he wasn't self-interested. He was interested in you know, shining the light of, love on other people.
Very interested in, like, consciousness and, like...
Yes.
Like,
did he see himself as not an individual, but part of something bigger?
Yes. Yeah, and he celebrated like his like guts and sweat and body.
I sound my barbaric yelp from the rooftops of the world.
Huh. And the the dark parts and the good parts. I'm totally digressing.
It's all good, man.
But as a way to say to everybody else, like every part of humanity is lovable, and I'm going to do the radical act of like loving every part of myself as well.
Right.
It's fascinating,
man.
But anyway. The guy whose head was lopped off by a guillotine.
Yes, what was spoilers. So radical about him?
To return to the previous digression.
Yeah, and my knowledge of the French...
Oh, got to go back circuitously to circuitine draft.
Yeah. My knowledge of the French Revolution is not great, but Jean-Paul Marat was this sort of muckraking, not newspaper man, but like pamphleteer during the terror. And just like intractably
kind of
propagandistic and radical, and his paper was just like notoriously hardline and violent. And he just sort of like wrote it out of his bathtub for a while before he was stabbed. It was great.
Love it.
Yeah,
I have a terrible in joke.
Please,
you'd think they would have called their party the Lopular Front. I'm sorry.
Shaking
this is a couple episodes ago. We're not going to get into it now.
Appreciate the panning of the audio there. That's a really nice.
Y'all got 14-ish minutes left.
So, yeah, we could do...
let's have like a radical pamphleteer.
Yeah, radical pamphleteer. And then, but that inspires, you know, maybe radical pamphleteering on the other side of the spectrum.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you could even sort of have it be, say, like, a couple of years after the revolution, whichever revolution it may be.
Sure.
Right.
And now instead of it kind of being whenever someone kind of finds themselves with a wrong opinion, they blame it on trolling. It is sort of like, oh, I'm just demonstrating the old values of capitalism before the revolution.
What if the pamphleteer's original purpose was to be able to like tell truths about the English government, let's say, in colonial America, where it was against the law to spread libel about the king, but there needed to be things discussed about how they were treating the U.S.
Yep.
And instead, after the revolutionary government is established, they are saying it's more gossipy or it's false or there's just like rumors that are circulating just like for funsies or for states rightsists or whatever, like Federalists versus other people. And instead it just becomes this like mishmash of things that you can't substantiate. But like you said, people are kind of demonstrating like, oh, well, I have a right to talk about things you're not allowed to talk about, right?
Right. think that this is very quickly going to a like WikiLeaks Julian Assange place of inevitably.
Doesn't have to be the U.S. That was just the historical example in the front of my mind.
No. And I think that like it will probably end up kind of in this place of like someone like that sooner or later kind of finds themselves in a position of I could really make a difference one way or another by deciding that, you know, all articles are equal, but some articles are more equal than others. And I'm going to start deciding which ones I'm going to actually push forward.
Yeah. Or what kind of free speech does Twitter permit? You know?
Right.
Right.
Still talking about it.
We've ended up right back there.
Man, this got dark, you guys. I love it.
Or you gave us a social face. Yeah.
I knew what I was setting us up for.
So I guess the question then is like, what is motivating this person?
Yeah.
What are sort of the values that they are chasing and that they are serving by starting this pamphlet?
Again, I think they need to kind of start in a place of real anger.
And just so I make sure I'm following. This is basically a Pandora's box story where somebody's like, I want my, like, I'm reading this news and it's not expressing my view on the world.
Correct.
And so, like, I'm going to make my news and it's going to be our news, like, with their community.
No establishment.
And right. And then by. And
it's going to be kind of like anarcho news.
Right. By, like, creating this precedence of, like, self-publishing.
But not everyone's a good actor.
A bunch of other people start self-publishing, like this wave swells and they're like, oh no, not you.
Right.
And then it's just this like melee, like chaotic free for all for attention. And like they're left like, you know, sort of under the ocean of bad information. And I don't know how this ends.
I think
that's where this resolves. Is it tragedy?
I think that is one way that it could go.
Okay.
And the other way that it can go is much more of a, you stare into the abyss stares back, sort of a corruption thing where he begins the anarcho newspaper, starts publishing, and for a while it's all great because it's kind of this agent provocateur, you know, thing. Then everybody's kind of like shaken loose of it, but nobody's taking it that seriously. But then at a certain point, a couple of people start showing up that are kind of going, that's the only newspaper that I trust. That's the only
one. Right, true believers.
The only one that I'm taking for real because it's the only one that speaks the truth and doesn't have an agenda. And slowly but surely, he starts gaining power. And slowly but surely, he then has to start making decisions about
like he becomes the editorial establishment.
Correct.
Oh my God.
Right.
Ezra Klein.
Yeah, I know, right?
We're casting.
Maybe our protagonist used to worked at a broadsheet and realized that the policies that he had to abide by were unjust. And so that's why he started this, you know, moonlit as a, you know, anarchist pamphleteer.
Yep.
Right.
And then realized that, oh, you know, maybe the point of view under which I worked before wasn't my point of view, but you have to have a point of view because you can't just uncritically, you know, publish everything.
Right.
There are layers here. And I'm loving this. So, protagonist, talk to me about this person.
We're talking about motivation, Sarah. So, what are you thinking?
Yeah, I like what you said about this is someone who has maybe history in the establishment.
I like that too.
And perhaps has always been looked down on in some way or is frustrated in their career trajectory or experiences. The other sort of option is that they sort of experience something that opens their eyes to the inequities of the system. And so this is someone who maybe like has had sort of, you know, sort of a cushy newspaper job and wakes up. And realizes either like I have to do something, you know, I won't be able to live with myself if I keep doing what I am doing. So I think this is someone who the two sort of motivations that make sense to me just on the surface are someone who has kind of this aggression of I want to be the person that I think I can be and I can't do it here. So I'm going to do it elsewhere. Or option B, this is someone who, you know, has sort of an epiphany and realizes mm-hmm. that like I need to change everything in my life and I'm going to do it this way.
I like that second one because I think it makes the eventual realization that he has become the thing that he you know was so contemptuous of mm-hmm. even more weighty.
I'll throw in another possibility into the mix that might be a little bit of a synthesis of both of these. He might sort of be in a position of kind of working for a newspaper, working as a reporter, and has done this massive, spent a year and a half working on this like huge investigative piece about, say, a rising party in the country, like sort of like the new, some people see them as extremists, some people see them as kind of like the rising hope of the country party.
Oh, this should be Britain in the 30s. I've decided now.
Sure.
3 days before it's going to be published, they get like the news from on top that like the newspaper was just bought by William Randolph Kane.
Sure.
And they have decided like we're killing that story. Like, you know, we are not publishing anything about
it. Or the government changed and suddenly they
totally.
Have to,
There is just sort of something where like for some reason the decision comes on high.
The
of,
good
like,
work that they've done is just like not.
And they have to take their cues from the prime minister or whatever.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
And they're not going
to
publish
they
about
have to
those
keep their
scoundrels.
Contacts in government.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Britain has like,
live to fight another
day. They have elections like that, you know, so they could totally be just a snap election called or whatever it's called.
There's snap. Whatever it's called.
There's some actual term. Sorry, Brits.
We got 6 minutes on the clock.
I love that.
Cool. That's a good that's a good way to start is we start with this person sort of getting the news that the thing they've spent the last year of their life doing
love
is
it.
Never going to see the light of day.
I mean, I don't love that. But
don't love
it.
That. Yeah. And then, you know.
And I think that would probably be important that they kind of be in this place of, I don't believe in this party, but I believe in their right to be heard. Like, I believe in their right for coverage. Like, I vote straight down the Tory ticket, but I think that the extremist front or whatever
Dems or something.
Liberal Dems
deserve their day in the sun,
right? Or maybe even something that's slightly more radical, like Sinn Féin or something like that.
Yeah.
Whoever they are,
Irish independence.
The political wing of the IRA.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And and covering that, and just realizing, covering radicalism, he ends up promoting radicalism, perhaps, and you know, giving kind of equal footing, you know, like Fox News style almost to people that shouldn't necessarily have that platform.
Yeah, and you could have sort of like a fun first/second act of like stealing a printing press, or you know, and like you know,
literal
like,
moonlighting, yeah,
right, exactly, yeah. And like grabbing people off the street, like you're a reporter now, go sit in this courtroom and like. Let me know what they said.
So, hey kid, here's a camera.
Right, exactly.
It costs $2,000. Don't worry about it.
So that was going to actually be my next question of like, who is bankrolling this? Or like, how is this happening?
I think he does it literally at night on the printing presses at
four and a half minutes.
At his
day job?
No, breaks in and like uses it when they're
like,
not being
used. Warm. Oh, I don't know.
Darndest thing.
Yeah. No, I think he does. And then he becomes like a celebrity where like every, you know, crackpot or radical is coming up to him and trying to gain coverage and he tries to please them, but then realizes that
could have like even like a money bucks person come to him and be like, you can have all of these resources. You just have to print this.
Right.
Ooh,
I think that is an inevitable first step down the slippery slope.
Yeah.
He does it by himself moonlighting once a week for like 6 months.
Yes. Love it.
And then then eventually it gets too big. Like there's too many stories. He can't keep up with it. He needs a staff. He needs his own printers.
No, he's like sleeping, you know, at a table, like with, you know, ink on his face and all that.
Right.
Yeah.
And somebody comes up and kind of goes, I will pay for the Anarcho Times of London. But that just means that like every day, like a little corner ad for Motherfucker Industry is going to be on there.
My heart breaks.
SponCon. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's out.
So
but
is,
you're
going
to be able to
climax
do it 5 times a week. Like you're going to be able to get so much more out there. Come on. You got to do it.
We'll send people to Belfast. Yeah. We'll do the whole thing.
Right.
So is the climax being forced to choose between publishing something that he knows to be false or knows to be biased and losing the paper?
Probably.
That's
like it's probably probably going somewhere in that direction.
Yeah.
Deal with the devil.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And of course it'll end with the paper running without him.
Yeah.
Right. Like it probably goes to kind of this like Project Mayhem thing.
Oh yeah.
At a certain point, like it's the beast is runs.
Does he blow it up? on his way out? Like, do they like fire him and then he like figures out how, like, I don't know if we want to go to that place.
I think maybe the optimistic final shot is like panning over like the dark windows of Broad Street or whatever the journalism street is. Fleet Street? No. Fleet Street? It doesn't matter. That's in Sweeney Todd. You see a few other lights on where a few other people, idealists, are moonlighting in their own printing, journalism like jobs. And, you know, the seed has been planted.
Yeah. I like that a lot.
I think that the inevitable scene that has to happen like 75% of the way through the movie is that, like, for whatever reason, he tells one of the people that work for him that they are not going to publish something. And that young kid is like, you know what?
Oh, yes.
I quit. Yes. I'm going to start my own newspaper where we can publish everything.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Yeah. Right, where we're not held down by the yoke of, editorial. Yeah.
Love it.
I'm not a part of your system, man.
Won't be censored.
Right, the after credits sequence can be like that guy's intern being like, screw you, dude, I'm going to start my own paper.
You sold out.
All this has happened before.
All this will happen again.
Oh, Battlestar. Christ.
I want to see this movie. This is great.
No, it's good.
90 seconds.
Oh, man. What's it called, guys?
I'm thinking like New Kids on the Block. I'm thinking the radical journalist of Fleet Street. I'm thinking there's many. What's the protagonist's name?
Oh, that's a good question.
Oh,
is it like Jonathan Sean Smith or something where he's like a secret Irish middle name?
Oh, maybe
his grandmother was Irish.
That.
Yeah.
All right.
And I don't know about the title. The Moonlit Times, the Moonlighting Times.
Freedom of the Press.
I know, right?
Press Descent. By Moonlight.
Descent. Maybe Descent. Just Descent.
Yeah, I like that.
I like that.
I like that a lot. Yeah.
Fewer words. You got to pan it. You got to
just gotta like focus it in.
The lesson I never learned.
We still got 10 seconds.
Yeah. And so the big reveal that is super surprising.
This is why people hate you.
Just the most important thing to learn is that.
And time.
Oh, well, never mind. I guess we don't
see it. This is why I can't be a writer, because I don't want to make anyone suffer, including the listeners.
You did pretty well at the writing thing.
That was dope.
Yeah,
thanks.
That was awesome. I did not expect this idea to land us here, and I'm psyched. I want to see this.
I know, me too.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for joining us. This was incredible.
My pleasure.
And thank you all for joining us, and we hope that you'll join us for our back half right after this. I'm going to do this super quick because I want to get back to our show and to our amazing guest, Amanda McLaughlin. But I just checked the computer, and guys, we're just $25 away from our next funding goal on the No Bad Ideas Patreon. Just $25. That's nothing. And you know what happens when we get there? Honestly, it is one of the worst ideas that we've ever had. I have no idea how Zach and Sarah talked me into it. But when we get to $150 per episode of No Bad Ideas, we're going to actually sit down and start writing a full script based on one of the ideas that we've developed on the show. It's going to be big and messy, and it's going to keep us up all night, and you guys are going to be able to enjoy an actual script based on one of the things that we've talked to on the show. Want to make this happen? We're so close, you guys. You can head on over to nobadideaspodcast.com/support. And there, you can sign up to help us make the show. You can give us whatever feels right to you every week. And based on that, we're going to be able to do more of the show. And we're going to be able to do more silly things like these stretch goals. So if you want to help us out, that's nobadideaspodcast.com/support. All right, let's get back to the show.
Welcome back, everybody, for the second half of the show with Amanda McLaughlin of Multitudes.
That's me.
Multitude?
Multitude, singular.
Multitude, singular.
Yes. I know. Went through lots of names for the company. Yeah. I had a list of like 100 plus.
That's so dope.
And ended
that's awesome.
Ended up going for the single word. Like I respect the kind of startup, you know, mentality of like, this is a single word brand.
Clean, professional.
I think my brain stitched in an S because we contain worlds. And so the last
line is, you know, I'm large, I contain multitudes.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Actually, I don't know why I made it singular. Now I'm thinking about it. I think it sounded better.
But I like it. Yeah, no, multitude.
Because it is a singular entity, perhaps.
And we are the multitudes.
It contains a lot, but it's still focused.
We record at the multitude.
Oh, my God.
Nice.
There's like Wesleyan.
Oh, man.
Like, we went to this college that had to put Wes in front of everything.
Oh, yeah.
I love it.
Harder with NYU. Can't really append that to any words.
That goes with the NYU vibe, though.
Yeah, They're like, we don't have time for this. I have a job.
Yeah.
So talk to me about, because it's funny, we were chatting a little bit before we started recording, and it shocked me that you don't identify as creative. And that's just a detail that I thought would be worth a jump off in the spirit of starting a conversation.
Yeah, I kind of happened on the metaphor a couple years ago that I feel more like a creative midwife. Like I get all of my creativity and satisfaction from helping other people make their creative ideas and like help birth their artistic works into the world.
I just had the unique experience of first laughing at a funny imagery and then being like, actually, that's so brilliant. Like, oh my God, like I was halfway through the laugh before I was like, no, that's perfect. That's amazing.
That is my ideal scenario. I like being just silly enough that you're like, I don't know. And then you're like, wait, that hit home.
Yeah, that's perfect. Absolutely.
Yeah. But no, and I mean, as a kid, I liked to write a lot and I wanted to be a writer. And then I got to, theater and I started working and I realized that I really love systems and like process improvements and just kind of like optimizing the workplace, which is again, like, you know, facilitating everybody else's work, making it a little bit better.
Which is its own
art.
Creativity.
Right? Yeah.
And but, the world of theater definitely needs.
Yeah, but like being the least creative person in a room of creative people, like being in like a group of, you know, 120 theater kids and being the one who was in charge of like making anything happen, like gave me a complex, I think.
Right.
But now I realize it's very much a strength because in a room of business people, like working in finance, I was like the wacky, creative, tattooed one with more than two earrings. Like, you know,
it was
very much like living in that liminal space gave me, made me feel strange, but now I realize like everything, that the thing that makes you weird is the thing that makes you better, you know, and like distinct, and it's a competitive advantage in terms of being like, you know, now I run a production company that is really good at doing business but also is like creative and interesting. So anyway, trying to make it work, but I very much am not like the artist in the room ever. But I try to bring a lot of creativity to operational stuff and logistical stuff, and it's a personal like, you know, hope for this year to make more room to just like make art for art's sake and doodling or writing more. I'm doing a lot of puzzles recently. Got a concussion and I couldn't read Twitter as much as I wanted to. Doing puzzles and listening to audiobooks. But yeah, so that's my little creativity baggage.
Wow. I hope you're on the up and up with the concussion.
Yes.
Okay.
It was I don't want to like do tourism to those with chronic illnesses, but it really made me prioritize my time. You know, if you could like look at a computer for 30 minutes a day, like you have to do the most important thing in the 30 minutes.
Totally. Right.
So it kind of helped me stick to my other resolution for the year, which is to be more intentional with my time and attention. So.
Oh boy, that's the trick.
Yeah. I know. Email twice a day now. That's it. I used to think my whole job was email, but now I just email twice a day. I didn't invent that, but it's very helpful.
Right. That's a very, I feel like that 4-hour work week book just like haunts me when I think about informational diets. I don't know.
I don't think Tim Ferriss knows much of anything.
Mixed feelings about the man.
Is there like a
Cliff Notes 100 version of this?
Words or less description of 4-hour work week for any of our listeners that might be
and
lost?
Me?
It's a book that sold really well, written by a guy that looks a lot like me with a lot less hair, did a lot of experiments on himself in another book that, and sort of like is a life hack guy, I feel.
Okay.
And sort of like a lifestyle guru kind of type.
I think what's really helpful is that he makes you think about the time and resources and like the different components of your life as like malleable. So you don't necessarily have to have a job where you like go to the office, like pay a bunch of bills to, you know, do takeout and dry cleaning and like, you know, Subways and like all the things that that entails, that you have an option of saying, you know, what do I want to spend my time on? How do I want to make that happen? How do I want to make money? It doesn't have to be the thing that I think I'm good at. And I think it's good to kind of prompt those conversations. But his particular version of it, there's a lot of like dropship bros, you know,
right. Like it's fundamentally rooted in a kind of exploitation where it's like, you know, you're
exploiting,
not hiring people locally
like non-US
in your area
workers, right.
That's a sustainable system.
Well, it's just one of those. Yeah, it's like we live in a really
it's like hacking
world.
You know, yeah. inequalities to your own advantage,
right.
Which I think it's why I'm inherently kind of like. Think it's gross, but I am a huge fan of the book So Good They Can't Ignore You by Cal Newport, who wrote the book Deep Work, which was very like trendy recently.
All right.
But yeah, it's similar where it's advice for new graduates or people exiting high school and saying like, hey, when you think about what job to get and what job to move on from there, it doesn't, you know, like what you should think about is not necessarily, okay, well, what career path should I commit to? Mm-hmm. But what next job can I get that gives me more tools to bring to the future job, because the way you get a dream job is not to like rise up through the ranks and get it anymore. That's just not what happens for most of us. It's that you have the skills, the seniority, and the like power to make your dream job for yourself,
and the portfolio of skills, because
and
the,
your portfolio of skills
one.
is what makes that happen. So I found it really really helpful as I like transitioned careers from finance to marketing and then eventually to working for myself, because I was kind of having a complex, like what in my resume going from a finance job to something else, like what is the like step down that's sufficiently transitionary enough? But instead it was like, no, what do I not know about marketing? Okay, so let's get a marketing job, you know, and like figure out, like round out that set, because I knew I would want that skill when I eventually worked for myself.
Oh, that's great.
What did you learn? What do you think is the secret of marketing for creatives?
Marketing is
just
storytelling.
Asking for a friend.
Marketing is storytelling. Marketing is just how you communicate yourself and what you do.
I need to write this down.
Yeah. I have a Skillshare course you can take. it is. I thought marketing was like, hey, corporations have billions of dollars to do billboards and like trick you into buying their thing. But marketing is just how it's branding. Like it's how you position yourself. Mm-hmm. So
very Seth Godin.
A little bit, yeah. And so having a way to like describe what you do, realizing what's different about yourself, realizing that you don't want to make art for everybody, but for someone really specific, or multiple really specific someones. Like my favorite exercise is the audience profile, where you think about like a really specific sentence, an individual or like a group of individuals that you want to make your art for. And then, you know, you can like go find where they hang out and make cool stuff in and with that community. And then becoming a part of the community, people want to check out what you do. And it's a much more like, you know, additive version of finding an audience than like, hey, let me buy an Instagram ad and like hope that I snag you with my like colorful GIF.
Right.
It's so funny you don't think of yourself as creative. You're just saying all these things that are just so creative. But anyway, I don't want to force an identity.
I think
on
I have a weird
don't...
combination of like environments and skills, which it turns out, y'all, that's very good. Like the more, you know, the looking backward, saying that I have a literature degree, worked in finance, then in at a business school, and then at a startup, makes complete sense that I would start a production company, right? Like like, of course, like that's, you know, you have all those skills. At the time, it felt like I was shooting myself in the foot over and over and over again, and like would be unemployable to the next person because these jobs looked so randomly distributed.
It's so funny you say that, because one of the pieces of advice I've been getting my entire life is focus, Valenti, from when they found I had ADD, and like, you know, everybody from my dad to the woman who ran the film department at Wesley, and Janine Basinger is just like, focus, Valenti. And in a way, it could look like, if you look at my resume, I've just been losing focus on things and just going from one thing to another. And then the other way to look at it is I've been rounding out a portfolio of skill sets, tool sets, and mindsets to just continue to do what I love. And I feel like hearing what you've said about like being a creative midwife, like that, it's when I've played that role that I've been the least stressed or anxious or worried or, you know, sort of like lost when I'm sort of working in service and in collaboration with others.
Yeah. And so maybe your description is that you are the guy that makes unexpected connections. You know, maybe that's it. Where like someone who works in blockchain wouldn't necessarily be really well versed in like philosophy and also film production. And so like that is so much more interesting than somebody who, you know, is a super specialist, which I again really respect. But like even from a hiring perspective, if I'm going to hire somebody at my, recruiting company, wouldn't I rather hire the person who has like a food podcast and really knows how to like find a specific community and like trace unexpected connections? Wouldn't that be more useful to me in my, you know, recruiting practice than someone who's only ever worked in corporate recruiting? Right, I just right. think it's like so much, it's much like better and less stressful. And that's something I wish someone told me earlier, is like, it's okay to leave things that are stressful behind. It's okay to like to optimize your life or your profession, not to do the things that you hate. And every at the end of every year, I make a list of, you know, things that I want more of, things I want less of. Actually, that was like on Instagram a whole lot by like goop style people this year. And I was like, no, don't take that. Like, it's mine.
But you could look at it the other way, where it's like more people are now having that practice than they would have otherwise had.
There it
is. And it's just like, you like, it's a mess, and like, we'll clean it up over time.
That's
like,
true.
We're just doing our best here. And like, you know, we came out of Goop primordially at some time. Point. I don't know.
Man,
we're
we are
still
just,
coming out of the goop.
We're just having an episode about getting in bed with the devil and just being like, this
will be okay.
But the devil's inside us. Like, it's part of, I don't
guys,
know.
Guys, we should have titled our movie The Netflix of Journalism.
Oh my gosh.
Shit.
Netflix of broadsheets.
Oh my God.
Damn. What's a Netflix? Don't worry about it.
Oh, man. Wow. Did they invent that model? No, don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it.
Jesus.
Oh, man.
And I'm curious what you guys have. I feel like we've just been like going back and forth. But I just hear an opportunity for the folks at home. Like, what do you think is like the biggest blind spot that you see in people, in creatives who are trying to make their life, their creative pursuit? Mm-hmm. I guess what's like maybe a pattern in something that you bring awareness to that sort of leads to... I don't know what I'm like trying to think of the right word.
Yeah, like sustainability or something. Yeah. Or satisfaction.
Like positive outcomes.
Yeah.
For creatives.
Yeah. I mean, I think probably, you know, Gabrielle and Sarah can talk to this too, but you're allowed not to make your art your day job. Like, you're allowed to have a life where you make money some way, you make art some way, you get, you know, social and familial satisfaction. You know, you don't have to have the combination that it feels like you're supposed to have. And like, I was very happy with a day job for several years as I was like figuring out what creative thing I wanted to do,
right? And
starting
like
the podcast,
vlog every April.
Yeah. Like, I was very happy to like be good at something and like learn a skill and have an environment where everybody, where I was new to everybody and I wasn't like known already. It was great, and I felt like the message was that I was a sellout, right? Like, I should have, by the dominant narrative, thought that I was a failure somehow. But it was like a very productive and satisfying time.
I would throw into that also, even if your podcasting is your day job, your life does not need to revolve around it. Like, it does not need to be like the center of everything.
Yeah.
No calling out at all intended. But just kind of like, you know, I kind of went from having a day job and doing Wolf 359 to kind of doing Wolf 359 and supplementing that with other freelance work. At the very start of the third season of the show, and we did four seasons, and for season three, Wolf 359 was what I did. Like, it was just like, that was the thing.
I feel like that's when we met, kind of 2016, 2017.
Yeah. And I think the last year that we did it, there was sort of this conscious effort to kind of be like, I'm not necessarily working on it any less, but I need to kind of have other outlets. I let myself travel again. I let myself go back home more. Mm. I kind of let myself have like a little bit more boundaries. That didn't always go very well. Sometimes those boundaries resulted in kind of, well, now I need to write this script quite fast.
Yeah.
Because I gave myself kind of the 2 days off that I felt that I needed. But it definitely kind of led to a marked increase in sanity and just increase in kind of well-being.
Yeah. And it's hard. Like, I taking time away from something, like, from the outside, a boundary can look selfish. It can look like you're, you know, not engaging with people who really care about a thing, or that you're like neglecting the community you're making a living in, like especially making a living in public online.
Yeah.
You know,
yes.
Like every day that I don't tweet about podcasting, you know, I sometimes feel a little bit self-conscious about that. But the fact is, like, I have like relationships and friends and habits. And, you know, I love to cook and pickle shit and like make bread and whatever. And, you know, all that kind of creative time is really essential to my creativity.
Yeah.
And that's completely allowed.
Yeah. You know,
Go ahead.
No, please, I insist.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that, like, it was sort of a couple months of angst. And I think regardless of whether you are building a portfolio or trying to specialize, the angst is there. It's real. It's always going to be there. But like where I sort of decided.
For a certain kind of brain. Some people just don't feel anxious. Isn't that wild?
That's wild, oh man. God.
I can't believe that.
Are you one of them?
No.
Okay.
No.
Just
checking. Oh, no, no, no. Oh,
but I'm sure that they exist.
Big yeah. anxious all times.
In this house, we practice angst.
But in any case, like I sort of was very, very stressed out that I wasn't good at Twitter, that I wasn't on it. And when I wasn't using it effectively. And that, you know, I should be tweeting about things and commenting and like getting involved and making friends and doing all the things that you're supposed to do when you are, a person in public who's trying to grow a career. And I just, at a certain point was like, you know what, this is a thing that I don't feel super comfortable with and I don't really want. And just like it was very freeing to let go of like, I want to be better at other things. You know, I want to be better about like riding a bike in Riverside Park on the weekend. Like that's totally what I want to be better at.
And I bet there are people who see that and say like, I so respect that you balance it that way and that you spend time on things that you want to be good at and you take your time to publish work that you're super proud of. And, you know, in the same way that you're worried about people think of you for not using Twitter enough. I think
and it feels like losing out. Like it feels like failure in a certain respect because, you know, there's this sense that we all have that's weird and ingrained about what we should be doing, whether that's artistic or sort of like the supplemental marketing stuff or operationally or just like what our lives should look like.
Oh, yeah.
And like half of the work of feeling good about myself, I think, is like catching myself thinking something and being like, why do you expect that should be real?
Right.
100%. Yeah. Hmm. No, I totally agree. And a lot of my like work in therapy and like angst in college and afterward was around, you know, the things I thought I should be doing. And like you said, when you stop to interrogate it, it's like, you know, who do I want to please? Is it myself? Is it the people I love and trust? Or is it like some amorphous like societal acceptance machine? And it's so much easier when you let go of that. And, you know, I think often like, you know, are the like six people I really care about their thoughts and feelings of me? Like, would this make them proud or not? And if I need some kind of guidance, like that is the lens that I want to be reverting to, not like what will look the most impressive or, you know, the like coolest.
Yep.
Right.
I was just thinking, when you were mentioning that so often boundaries have a way of feeling a little bit selfish and feeling a little bit kind of like you are cutting off something else kind of out of a place of, just kind of like selfishness. I was thinking about back in college, I did a lot of technical theater. Like I was often kind of on the lighting teams for kind of the student theater productions.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were very tall.
At Wesleyan.
That really helps.
Yeah.
You only have a 10-foot ladder. Really helps to be tall.
Oh, yeah.
This was why I only ran crew. I did not light
See,
anything.
You would be a great subject for focusing lighting, where you could stand in for
I've done that on several occasions. Yep.
Oh, yeah. It's very good. Yeah.
But we would often run into these moments where we would need the space in order to do something during Tech Week.
Oh, yeah.
And
and
we would sort of often run into kind of this thing where like the actors would also be needing it for rehearsal. And we would kind of be going, well, how long is this going to take? And sort of the actors would sort of be going, kind of as long as it takes. Like, we're still finding this. We're still doing this. Like, this is kind of the play. We can't rush this. And I remember sort of back then kind of feeling very much like, no, like, that's right. Like, the priority for it is the actors. And, like, it would be kind of very, very selfish of us to kind of go, no. At 9 p.m., we're kicking all of y'all out so that we can hang these lights. And now I've completely gone back the other way around of kind of like, no, like having those firm boundaries of kind of like, look, actors, like from 9 to 11, this is tech space. And trust us, everything is going to go so much better, and you're going to feel so much more prepared for having these lights
of their work
nicely focused to really support you.
Yeah.
And it is also kind of this like imposing a very horrible artificial division between kind of like there's the tech side that is here just for logistics, and they can suffer in the name of the people that are here to do the creative thing and to do the artistic thing.
I mean, that's the like urgent versus important, you know, distinction as well. And I mean, something like when I read the phrase self-parenting in like psychology type stuff, when I was first like, you know, becoming an independent adult, that really struck home with me because, you know, like boundaries, rules, bedtimes, like, you know, all this stuff, it can sound dismissive when you like use, you know, parenting as like a metaphor for stuff that we do to among our peers.
Absolutely.
But it is really helpful. And in being a boss too, like I'm a boss of my friends now, you know, and that is like a big shift in, hey, we're all just like people trying to make a cool thing together. It, you know, it gets more complex and better, but also worse when you kind of professionalize and formalize, professionalize in big quotes. But it's really, you know, at a certain point, like I have to respect myself and trust my friends enough to know that that I have some kind of like social currency with them, that if I like make a decision that ends up being wrong, or if I like say something or need something that is in the moment inconvenient, that like we all know that there's a bigger goal, and I trust that they trust me to know enough that like I can be forgiven. And so like leaning in, I almost picture it like leaning against a trampoline or like putting my foot in some mud. Like I need to trust that there is some give there and that it'll bounce back.
Absolutely.
This reminds me of, I was recently listening to an interview with Jeffrey Katzenberg, I get his name right?
Yeah, this is the...
former DreamWorks animation guy. He's doing this Quibi thing now, like quick bites, making, I don't know, new video thing, subscription service. We'll see.
The book Disney War is about the like corporate fight for Disney after Walt Disney's death.
It is so fascinating.
I want to read that.
And he is like the like underdog in that book.
Huh. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, he had this really cool thing that he said something that I really liked, which was you have to give creatives room to fail and permission to fail. And it's one of those things that's just like, I don't know, when you start playing that game, Yellow Car, you start seeing yellow cars everywhere. Like I've just heard across the board of like artists I admire, like Donald Glover talks about like, you know, permission to fail and getting permission to fail and how, you know, people who grew up where he grew up had very little room. Like he felt like he never had any room to fail. And so he's had to be grinding and sort of like everything he's done has had to be perfect. And just that, you know, that pressure.
Yeah.
But and then it makes failure devastating.
Right.
In a way that's really hard to recover from.
And like Brené Brown writes about this in all of her writing about shame. She's like a psychologist and researcher. And each of her books, I roll my eyes at the title and then I read it and I'm like, I'm fundamentally changed. Like, yeah, I see it. I get
it. Checks out.
But she writes about shame in a way that was really persuasive for me. And like when I realize that, you know, I've like made a mistake or I've not done something that I should do, especially with like the public facing business. Like we didn't have a trailer for my primary podcast. It's 3.5 years old. Like we didn't have a trailer to like have
Spirits
in podcast
app. Didn't have
app.
A trail for nope. 3 years?
Nope.
I mean, we don't have a trailer.
And
do we?
Nope.
Fans made one.
And it was after we published an article about how to write great trailers that Eric Silver wrote for Join the Party and Horse that I was like, well, all right, need to follow my own advice. All right, here we go. And it was embarrassing to post it in my mind because then it highlights the fact that it wasn't there.
Yeah. Right.
But the fact is, like, I can now point to it and say, hey, it's really useful. And even if your show is still around or still going or finished, it's useful to have. Right. And just like every time I like let myself improve in public, it is like stifling and super embarrassing and makes me feel shame at first. But then I look back and I'm like proud of myself for having done it. Or someone says, hey, I appreciate that you know, did this and talked about it because it made me realize that I could too, or something along those lines. But, you know.
So how do you balance? Like, so I love the idea of improving in public. And then I've had stuff and I like, you know, sort of was in this mindset of like, everything must be shared. So like, how do you find the boundary between improving in public and giving yourself space to fail privately so that it's not this like, you know, you don't start to create an image of yourself of like, you know, somebody who's too green, right?
Yeah.
I
think two things. I know, right? That's the big fear. But one is that I try really hard not to be defensive of my own decisions. That is absolutely like the human condition and the default.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I want to do this.
I'm sorry.
Or you know, my brain is always set in like disaster mitigation mode. Mm-hmm. And so if I have an inkling of a thought like, oh no, this decision I made or this like, again, like lack of a trailer or something, might not be the right one, or like the website might be bad, or like the name might have to change. My immediate brain, you know, reflex is to say like, oh, no, it's fine. Like, or to find all the ways to justify the status quo, because right. not changing is easier and less embarrassing than changing.
Procrastination pays off right now.
Exactly. So I try really hard to like, let my own decisions be just as in scope as everybody else's when it comes to like needing to improve or needing to change my own mind. And that makes, and the kind of flip side of that is not wanting to, or trying not to be afraid of committing to a decision where like I will procrastinate making choices for months. I put off making multitude for months and months and months because I didn't want to like commit to this idea in case it failed. And so for me, working with a team is really, really useful because, you know, they will say useful questions like, okay, like what's the worst case scenario? That seems okay. Like, shouldn't we do it then? And I'm like, yeah, we should. So, you know, helping and kind of being open about my process and letting other people into the like icky goo of indecision and not just like presenting them with the perfectly like cut diamond of a decision, nice. You know, when it's all done.
That's an important thing creatively as well, at least. Like that was a big anxiety for me when we started writing, was just like, I wanted things that I showed you to be good and perfect. And it wasn't until I was comfortable pitching awful things that like better new things arose from that, because, you know, having different perspectives and having people to, you know, take very seriously your ideas and want them to be better and like want to hold you accountable. Like that's how the magic happens.
Yeah. And for me, that involves a lot of like talking about emotions too.
Yeah.
Where, you know, I really don't want to admit to a friend when they've hurt me, or I don't want to admit to them a fear, you know, that I have when showing them something.
Right.
I have had with every single person that I work with, like, you know, hour and a half long, like, hey, I need to talk about either a way that I feel I failed you, or a way that I feel that you've hurt me, or whatever it might be. And like, as a, you know, I am super conflict averse, super don't want to talk about feelings, but like, I really make myself do that, because I think at the end of the day, like we all respect each other and believe in each other and respect the work and respect our audience enough that we can like push through that discomfort. And the moment it's done, it's like, oh, why was I so scared of that? You know,
right.
Yeah.
Making me want to make some phone calls.
Yeah. And like, you know, it's again, like letting other people support you is like giving them an opportunity to prove themselves and to show friendship and to like demonstrate service and always withholding and being like, nope, I got it. Don't worry about it. It's fine. That's depriving my friends of an opportunity to show up for me.
Wow.
And that really is the thing that allows me to say, you know, yes, I need help, or yes, I need a moment, or, you know, I want feedback on this because I'm not sure.
There's this fantastic Benjamin Franklin quote, and I'm going to butcher it, but it's something on the order of, if you want to make a friend, ask someone for a favor.
Yeah. And the dark side of that is kind of Dale Carnegie style.
Yeah.
It's also true that help, like asking your listeners to help you, makes them really, you know, really want to be involved in the community and feel really invested. But you're right that there's a really positive side. And it's true. Like it makes me better, you know, like having Eric Silver edit everything I write makes me a better writer. Like having Julia, you know, run social media because I was bad at it makes our social media better. And you know, running like a pilot of a new show by all seven of us in Multitude, you know, all of whom have different artistic tastes and opinions and all of whom give great ideas that make me rethink the whole concept. You know, it's uncomfortable in the moment, but it makes everything better in the long run.
So at risk of opening a can of worms, because I love this, the last stone that I'll throw into this pond, because a lot of the ideas you've been talking about, marketing and sort of, you know, just I've been deep in a Seth Godin hole. He's talks about marketing a lot, got some TED Talks books and stuff. One of the things that he said that like really had me stop in my tracks and think about what was bothering me about being on social media when I was really in it, when we were doing Wolf and just kind of inclined to share everything and sort of in this like manic place of just like,
I didn't answer your question. Like, did I? Yes.
Well, continue. Well, so the question is like, what do you think about this idea that authenticity is overrated, which is something that when I heard it, my gut reaction was like, that's wrong. That's wrong. You got to be vulnerable. Like Brené Brown said, like preach. But right. Then like you think about it for a second. It's like, well, do people show up at McDonald's? And I don't think, you know, like gross meat, like bad business, not, I don't know, you know, so, but like, you know, people don't show up at like a nice restaurant and want to hear a sob story about like why their dinner is not what they expected to get off the menu. You know, they want what was on the menu. And so it's like, as a creative as an artist or as a business person or as, you know, somebody who is offering something to the world, like, where do you see that line of like how much to show behind the curtain versus at what point are you like, maybe, I don't know, like it in a, just that sentence of like authenticity is overrated. Like I could see where he was coming from. Like nobody cares that I feel sick today. Like I got to talk about marketing today. Like that's what people come to my blog for.
Yeah.
And that's why I have a living and I want to keep sustainable serving people that like give a damn about what, you know, and he's like promoting of ideas, vegetarianism and, you know, these memes that are, I think, good for the world.
To me, the things that are easiest to share are the least useful. And so I have no problem, you know, talking about like an embarrassing mistake I made if I don't think it's that embarrassing. Like, you know, it's like of the like 1 to 10 scale, it's pretty easy for me to share like 1 to 8. And like I, for example, I came out on my YouTube channel like almost two years ago, which was a little bit nerve wracking, but like pretty easy, much easier than like saying the words to an individual in front of me. Always. Like I came out on my YouTube channel to my parents. Like I sent them the video like that. Like that's how I did it, because I couldn't muster up the just, you know, language to say it to them in person.
It's easier to say in a camera that you can then go back and edit. I did the same thing.
And that, you know, that I find, like in myself, if it's pretty easy to talk about, then I probably don't need to be talking about it. But the process of like, you know, dealing with my parents' divorce or falling in love and figuring out how to like have an adult partnership with somebody, you know, being a friend and sibling and not a parent to my adult brothers and sisters, like, you know, all of these things that have really taken up like the real head and heart work, as this great podcast Just Break Up says, of my adulthood is not the stuff I talk about publicly, because I feel like the arena for it is like very much internal, or my like intimate sphere of the people it affects. Yeah. And I'm 100%. Happy to talk about that work after it's done. But, you know, I don't know. I want to, it's almost like, you know, in meditating, you have to be alone with yourself. And that's the most terrifying thing. Like for me, real personal development, like I need to be alone with myself and really just go through it and not be distracted by, you know, putting it out there and like using that as a, you know, a distraction.
All right. So I think that that is all the time that we have for this episode, No Bad Ideas. Amanda, thank you so much for coming by and sharing both your amazing story sensibilities and your tremendous wisdom with all of us and with all of our listeners.
Thank you. This is super fun. And I love the show.
What are you working on these days? Like, what are you doing now?
Where should people who want to find you go?
Well, I am working on Multitude. So the website is multitude.productions. We are working on new shows. We are working on live shows. Ooh, we are working on more resources and free stuff for people who are aspiring podcasters and creatives. Working on doing my newsletter more regularly because I need to and I don't. and that makes me shameful, but I'm going to do it anyway. And yeah, it's just, you know, there's a lot kind of behind the scenes and just like the daily work of, you know, booking ads, listening to people's emails, you know, like making sure the podcast goes up in time, is really exciting. So sign up for the newsletter, follow us on social at Multitude Shows. And, that's a good way to keep up, but lots of really good stuff coming for this year. So
what about you? If people wanted to follow you specifically?
Oh, sure. I'm also an individual outside of my, company.
Yes. Despite rumors to the contrary.
I am. Yeah. Traveling a lot, getting more tattoos, dressing more and more like a 90s dad.
Nice.
I'm at She's So Mickey on Twitter and Instagram. Those are my main places.
Excellent.
And I co-host three podcasts, actually. One is Spirits, a boozy dive into mythology, legends, and folklore. One is Join the Party, which is a collaborative storytelling and role-playing podcast. That sounds very beautiful. It's Thanks, so Brandon Krugel. And thirdly, Waystation, which will be on hiatus shortly, but it's like a rewatch podcast with Eric Schneider on the queer Canadian TV show Lost Girl, which was a flash in the pan and everyone should know and love. So if you just put Multitude into your podcast player, you can see all those shows.
That's awesome.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for hanging out, and thank you all of you for tuning in. Future.
This has been No Bad Ideas, produced by Gabrielle Urbina, Sarah Shackett, and Zach Valenti. Today's episode features music by State Shirt and Jazar from freemusicarchive.org. You can support the show at patreon.com/nobadideas. And if you love the show, please leave a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Thanks. See you next week.